item on the workshop, on the agenda, and Mr. Lank has done an outstanding job of framing the issue. So, Mr. Robertson, we have your memo in front of us. Shall we start marching down the list?
Sure. The first one is to clean up the cluster ordinance of the zoning code. Really quickly, there were amendments to that, and the final product that ended up in the code is a jumble, in some respects. There were two amendments. There was the original ordinance, then there were two proposed amendments that got introduced in an order, and then they got adopted in reverse order from the way they're introduced. So because of that, they just don't match up right in the wording of the ordinance. Things don't match up right in the ordinance when you try to go through it. So my opinion on that is basically to just go through it, not change what it's supposed to say, but instead make it say what it's supposed to say, I guess. You know, that's just strictly housekeeping on that one.
Well, we consider that minor in housekeeping, but we still have to go through the process.
Yeah, yeah.
Worthy goal, though. Let's get that straightened out. So.
And I've had conversations about that with other attorneys, too, and they recognize that there's some problems with it. The second one is there's a need to put the definition of substantial construction, the same definition in both the subdivision code and the conditional use section of the zoning code. There's currently a definition for it in section 9940 for subdivisions, but not one for conditional uses. That's important because that triggers whether or not your conditional use is expired. The opinion that I've given and that prior county attorneys have said, well, if it's silent in conditional uses, but it's spelled out in the subdivision code, you know, you would use that definition because it's still within the county code. But at the same time, we ought to make it clear.
Well, it's different because you're dealing with, typically on a subdivision, you're dealing with streets and there's no improvements other than infrastructure. There's, you know, where if it's a conditional use, it really, the conditional use would approve for a building, say a multifamily building.
Right.
And they put everything else in, but they haven't put the building in.
Right.
Building what was approved, technically.
That's the use,
And we have a couple issues like that.
Yeah. That one may require a little more lifting, but anyway, it's one that needs to be in there because it's silent right now for conditional uses. So I don't know if you all have a thought on that.
Would it relate to the construction of the actual conditional use?
Yeah, that's what I think, you know, Lawrence and Shane and I have talked about. You know, like, it's one thing to put a parking lot in, but if it's a parking lot for a, I don't know, a Dairy Queen, you ought to have the Dairy Queen.
At least substantial under construction.
Yeah.
We have an approval for a multifamily use. They put the entrance in the code. They put the driveway in, the parking laid out. It's not in because it's going to be under the units. They put the sidewalks in. There's probably, there might be a street light in there. The only thing they haven't done is create an access to another parcel. That was one of the conditions of approval. But they haven't never gotten a permit even for the first unit. And it's close or already has terminated as far as the 3 years.
Right. So we need to get that.
That's just one example.
You're right. So if that's something you all are okay with, I can, you know, sort of present that. And that's something that's come up at council before, too. That's not an issue that they're not unaware of or not expecting.
But under a conditional use, Lawrence, I mean, would a completion deadline be appropriate?
We haven't. We have it's basically a substantial underway.
And that's more definite date, a certificate of occupancy.
Let's say we give them 3 years.
Bright line.
And you might take 2 years just getting all your permits, and they start construction, but they're not finished.
In a standard subdivision, you know, you don't know what the market's going to do, so units may move faster or slower. So it's hard to put a completion date on a subdivision. So substantially underway makes sense in some definition of it. But in a conditional use, you're applying for a specific purpose use. So you would think that, hey, you've got some idea of occupancy or tenants, so let's get it constructed and then go ahead and get your tenants by a deadline date. Now, that date might be negotiable at the public hearing and through the public hearing process and that whole discovery. But, you know, under conditional use, a completion date seems to make more sense to me than substantially underway.
Well, we depend on the size of the project. If it's a small project, you could put a completion date on.
Yeah, because we do get subdivisions.
Some of them go on for years, and you're like a mobile home park. You might have a couple hundred lots approved, and the only first phase might be 50. There's substantial underway. They might not put the next 50 in for 5 or 10 years, but it's still valid.
An interesting way to do it.
They should have to go back and get an update on all their agency of permits because it changes if they haven't got approval for that.
Well, maybe we should allow the opportunity to choose, you know, a deadline versus a substantially underway.
Yeah, we had one, just, I'm just trying to use examples. We have a used car lot that would approve as a conditional use. It's almost run out as far as deadline, but the building's up. He's now put the cars in. But it, basically, it's completed, and it's pretty close to the deadline date, where some of the bigger projects would be the ones that would be difficult. And it depends on what the project is. If it's the biggest one would probably be a mobile home community, because they're going to do it in phases. So how many phases are you going to allow? And the market might say, you might never finish it. We're dealing with the Nanticoke Shores, for example. They want to convert part of theirs to a campground, and the campground issue is totally separate, totally different. Right, so they couldn't develop the rest.
Right, because they could have
worked a little bit harder to get it done.
Right, because in the meantime, they haven't even begun to develop the rest of the mobile home park.
No, they're only half to a third of half done.
It has to include at least one residential.
I just wanted to remind Mr. Robertson, too, that, and tell me if I'm wrong, but under the new CR1 zoning, you get your housing under a conditional use now. So you're not getting your by rate 12, so yeah, you've got some CUs in the CR1 that aren't a Dairy Queen or aren't a car lot
that's really the residential. That's really about the only difference between a C1 and a CR1.
Yeah.
I took the multifamily out.
But, you know, think of the practicality of it. If you have a three-phase project, regardless of what it is, and so why is it so important that it be substantially underway if the third phase may never be completed for 10 or 15 years?
And in some cases, you'll never see them finished.
Right. I mean, so why is it so important to see them get started? I mean, I'm not saying it isn't, but if it's not important to see them get completed, then why is it so important to see them get kicked?
Well, if it's not substantially underway by that certain date, then it can be void.
Yes, yeah, then it's not there.
Not there, basically, right, because it's not. Yeah. And there's several of those.
That's a pretty good answer, I think.
Several. More than I thought.
That Fenwick Medical Center.
Finding more all the time, I bet.
That's what I've been doing for quite a while here lately. I didn't even deal with Sunday, and I really got into the conditional. Charging.
That Fenwick Medical Center. But
oh, yeah, that's right.
They're never going to build it. They've done nothing.
And it probably is terminated. I haven't pulled all the dates on all of them yet. But, and, you know, and again, there's so many different types of conditions. When we get done going through Vince's two memos, if we haven't addressed it on his memos, there are some other things that we need to just look at the conditional uses, for example, or the special use exception with the board, and see if there isn't something that could be flipped from conditional use to special exception with the board, or maybe a couple that are going to the board maybe should come back to the commission and council. They get some controversial things in their meetings too.
Just don't give us cell towers.
I know.
We don't want that.
That wasn't one of the ones I was going to say.
Thank you.
That's all. You know, they could do public hearings on those. And
right.
One of the biggies that they have.
Well, we can see that's one that needs to be addressed anyway.
So. But again, the commission meets now, but at 7 o'clock tonight, the board meets.
Yeah.
And the board's going to address similar issues to what you're addressing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was talking about with a substantial completion. You can see that's one that...
Yes, that definitely needs to be.
Especially on
the conditional uses.
Yeah.
And it maybe need to be tweaked in both.
Yeah,
that's both true. Ordinances, just for bringing it up to standards.
The next one is gets a little more... into sort of policy, I got to admit, than I wanted to, but it's 99.9C, particularly in light of some of the events recently, you know, whether, you know, that should be strengthened, I guess, for lack of a better word, you know, regarding its impact on approvals or denials, if we want to make, you know, it more mandatory or have more teeth in it, you know, that may be an issue for another day, because that's not so much cleanup as it is really getting into the heart of, you know, the subdivision ordinance. Oh boy.
The one thing on that issue would be, from what we've heard from the attorneys representing us on some of the cases, is that yes, you have a 99-9C, but there's nowhere else in the ordinance that describes why you're reviewing 99-9C. So we almost need a paragraph or a page or something related to to forest to wetlands, right on down the list.
Right.
So that you, when you make that a point that you use in your decision to deny or approve that says it meets that criteria, why does it meet that criteria?
Well,
we need to have it in the ordinance somewhere that shows.
That's what we need, though. We need the ability to,
beef it up.
Approve or deny on the basis of that, which we don't seem to have right now.
Right.
Well, the only thing it has is that 99C little one-liner, two-liner little paragraph that relates to that one issue, but it's nowhere else in the case. And that's what I picked up from a couple of the
attorneys. Yeah,
A better defense for us if we have.
Yeah. I agree.
Right.
Okay.
The next one, this one, and I'd like to hear Lawrence and Shane's input on this one, because I think the code doesn't match what we're doing. 99.8 says that the applicant needs to provide a notarized list of adjacent property owners, and I think that that's something that you folks do.
We've been doing it. No, we get probably one out of 100 brought in by the attorney.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the engineer saying that this is the list of people within 200 foot. We do it because the tax maps are there.
Right.
And
you'd have to check it anyway, probably.
There's some left off. It's only a courtesy, but it probably should say in the code it's a courtesy. You're just trying to help notices get out. Yeah, it needs to be. It probably should just reference that you take it out, or just reference that the staff will prepare it.
Yeah.
But what I found, we had one recently that either the attorney's office or the engineers provided, and they missed immediate neighbors. Immediate neighbors.
The problem is, though, if it's a courtesy, we run into that with the board case where they start saying, well, if you're going to do it at a courtesy, you got to get it right, you know, or
that's
a notice violation.
Did
you
do it at all?
Well, the state law says we have to post and advertise.
Meaning the newspapers and stuff, yeah.
But we've done this courtesy thing since the 70s, sometime in the 70s.
I think it's a good idea, but if you're going to get hung up on it.
I'm not saying we're getting hung up. We've been doing it. The staff's been doing it for every board case, every change of zone, every condition, every subdivision.
I have to say, I don't know that council would go for taking it out. I think
it's been too long.
Yeah. It's not in, really. It's a courtesy.
No, it's a courtesy, but still a courtesy, but we're just do it.
Yeah.
And we've done it for so long.
I think you should.
It'd be a major reduction in the budget, because you just wouldn't believe what our postage and handling is with our advertising. It's all interrelated.
Tell them that. That might change their view of.
But the only thing you have to be careful of is if you codify it, then someone doesn't get noticed, like we've had a couple people for some reason.
Oh, you always do.
We'll see. Yeah, it's codified.
And then
now, you
have to be concerned about whether that negates the public hearing itself.
Right.
You know, its entirety, because someone didn't receive something in code. Mm-hmm. So maybe the courtesy policy should continue and be careful about.
All right, we try.
With all the
legal, but we do find mistakes.
With all the, notwithstanding the audience, with all the attorneys that are always looking for a little niche.
Well, you know? Where I find we've had the problem is that they look at the tax maps, and they find the site in question, and there's a subdivision next door. For some reason, they don't pick up anybody in that subdivision. I've seen that happen several times, because it's not right there on that map. They got to go find it somewhere else, and then they look at the other map and they don't figure out where to. Who those people are that are affected.
Right.
We can't, and typically what we do, what I try to do then is I at least send a notice to the HOA who owns the streets or the open space or the stormwater area, because it's got a parcel number. So we can send it to them. They can notify them. So at least we get that one. Okay. We've done that before too.
So that one needs to be fixed though.
This one,
it doesn't reflect what we're doing.
And now would you fix it so that staff provides it.
Yeah.
I think it makes more sense because we have the maps available. These people that are coming in from out of town don't.
Yeah, right. And because the problem is, I think if you say that the applicant has to do it, then it takes it out of the county's control, and we're going to be spinning our wheels and wasting time because the applicant's going to screw it up. Mr. Schrader's clients. But
that's been in there since the 70s. I know that from the beginning, because originally that's what it said.
Yeah. So, okay.
And again, if it could be referenced as courtesy, that this will be provided, it might give us a little edge, but probably not much.
You're right, but okay. This one, I think, also may. I got to look at the statute again, but Section 99.9A talks about times of hearings and decisions. It says, the decisions need to be made at the second regular meeting of the commission, which I don't even know what that refers to anymore. I mean, the commission meets twice a month, and I think that was back in the 70s when they were meeting, I don't know, irregularly. So anyway, I think that needs to be clarified or deleted, really, as far as that. This is one for Shane and Lawrence, too. When we talk about re-subdivision of an existing subdivision plan, it talks about 51% of the property owners, and we've gone round and round on that. Does that mean each lot, you know, if you have one deed with 14 people on the deed, do they get 14 votes as opposed to their neighbor who may get one or two?
That reads like that because of coal. And how many times did we do that, Lawrence? 15 times before we got them satisfied?
The unknown participant.
Did I hear a voice?
Did somebody hear this? Is a public meeting. It is not a public hearing. We're not scheduled to solicit public testimony. However, since you are known to be a person with some experience in these matters, I think it's within our purview to query you since you're here. So consider yourself queried.
Thank you.
And I don't even live in Rehoboth.
He wrote this letter.
So I think you have a little knowledge of how things got to be the way they are.
Lawrence and I wrote that.
The board of the county has the right to ask them a question.
I understand.
We do have the right
to do that, and we're going to exercise that at this time.
Lawrence and I wrote that.
But stop. Can you give your name and place of residence?
Dave Schaefer. I'm a query from Dennis Schrader, Georgetown. Lawrence and I wrote that in response to some problem we have with George Cole, and the idea was to write it so that 51% of the owners could make the application. But where it bogged down was that Cole and whoever his sidekick was at that time couldn't grab onto the idea that if 51% of the people applied for the application, but the covenants required 75% in order to have a consensual amendment or 100%, why you wouldn't require 100% to get it going? And, you know, the distinction between the law and the covenants was, it was a mess. I know we went through probably as many as 4 or 5 iterations of that thing. And the idea was to at least get it on the table and let people...
Right.
The argument's been that if there's 100 lots and 49 of them are still owned by the developer, does he get 49 votes?
The definition of a property owner is it the developer?
And Cole's theory was that that was one vote.
Yeah, he was. That's right. He considered that one.
He considered that one vote, even though it may be 49 votes under the covenants.
Unless you work it into the...
So what would prevent the... a developer from just re-deeding one of the lots to the lower Delaware phone book and creating all the votes he needs.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, he could, but he'd have to get it back at some point.
Well, and it strikes me, I mean, if you own, you know, 51 or 49 lots, if you're the developer, I mean, if you own a majority of the property, you ought to be able to vote a majority of the property. I mean...
Agree with it.
And that may be satisfied by Dukiah when
they... Well, that's true. That's true.
That's something we could look at.
Yeah.
There's got to be some reference there, maybe.
Yeah, I think there is, actually.
But I think that the problem you're going to run into is if you were to bring up an amendment to that particular section, you're going to wind up in a storm that you can't get out of.
Well, the problem is we've wound up in legal storms with different court cases. It's been, what, 6 or 8 years ago. I know we had that one, what was the one there, Peddler's Village, where that came
out. Yeah, Nowakowski.
Yeah.
But as I read this, Vince, what you're saying on here is just clarify the reference to 51% of the property owners asking that question. Is it each lot or each person on the deed?
Right.
You're not getting into the can of worms of the 75% or 100%. You're just saying
it should, right. Is it 51% of the lots?
51, you know, and then the others. Another issue for another day.
Right. Because it seems like every time we have to count them, we always go, okay, does that mean each lot gets one vote, or does that mean each person on each deed gets one vote? You know, there's every time there's that question, and it'd be nice to just have that question answered, you know.
The better...
So you're saying each lot should get a vote? One.
Well, I think better answer might be to define...
That's why we've been doing it.
Define property owner somewhere else in the code, hide from that section.
Right. Well, that's true. Because the thing is, I mean, and we've been counting each lot as one vote, but the actual code says 51% of the property owners, you know, so somebody could, you know, run with that if they wanted to potentially.
Yeah, that's the key. And that's what you want. Yeah.
That might work, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Can I rejoin the crowd, Mr. Chairman?
Find a seat.
However, don't go too far away, because we may have to query you again.
This one, yeah, I'd be interested to know if Mr. Schrader has any input on this. 9915F talks about all major commercial, this is the subdivision code, all major commercial and industrial development, and it then also talks about, or subdivision along the major arterial roadways of Sussex County, shall be prohibited unless the major commercial industrial development shall provide service roads adjacent to all major arterial roadways. Yeah, that's fine.
What's yours?
I'm just questioning why that's even in there, because that seems like that's something that should be moved to the industrial zone of the zoning code and the commercial zone, the CR zone or C1 zone of the zoning code.
I don't know. Must have been plagiarized from another ordinance.
Well, because the thing is that, you know, I guarantee that nobody that's doing a commercial development even looks at that section.
That's what that came about when we did the strip lots on the major arterial roadways.
Yeah, it wasn't an amendment. Yeah. That was 8 and 91.
So anyway,
that's when that came about, I believe.
It could be. And it's really a Del Dot issue.
Well, yeah, that's true. It may be one that, you know, we delete, if not, at least bring it to council's attention and either get it in the right zoning code section or, you know, get it out of there altogether. So,
Is there in the same wording in the zoning ordinance? I don't remember that.
I don't remember seeing it in the zoning ordinance.
That's really where it should be.
Yeah. I mean, there's reference to major arterial roadways in the zoning ordinance for, like, big box stuff and whatever else, but
I thought it referred back to the subdivision code.
Well, it does for the definition of major arterial roadways, but not back to 9915F. Anyway, all right. Well, I'll take a look at that if there's an agreement to do so. Is there sort of a
yeah.
Okay? 9916D1. This is just something I don't understand. And Lawrence, take a look at your version of the code. There is it. It seems like whenever General Code published this one, they left D1 hanging out there, and it doesn't seem to fit. It actually shows up in 9926.18 where it belongs, so I just think that's a cleanup just to get that deleted out of there.
Well, it's two different things. It might have been in the wrong place. I never noticed that.
I know. I looked at it. I couldn't figure out what it was there for.
But that's basically what we do, and it probably shouldn't be there for this. You're talking about suitability, land preservation, natural features, and that's why it's there. Space for the signature of an authorized representative of the conservation district approving location design of all stormwater management. That's where we get the district to sign off on our final subdivision plan.
Yeah. And why do I have 9926?
But I don't know why it's there either.
Yeah, because it shows up as in section 26. Mm-hmm. It's restated, so.
I think maybe that was just a printing error and should be removed.
Yeah. Doesn't make any sense.
Is it the same wording?
It's exactly the same.
Yeah, it's in the wrong place. Okay. That somehow got printed that way.
And then the last one on here was for amenities, bonding. You know, we've been dealing with this, and the bonding guarantees in Section 9932 talk about street and road improvements, surface drainage facilities, erosion, sedimentation control facilities, water supply, sewers, forested buffer strips, and open spaces. The county's been requiring the bonding to include amenities as well, and if we're going to do that, we should make sure that the code says it, just so, again, we're tying what we're doing with what the code requires.
So. That roads as well, Vince?
Yeah. Well, it depends. If it's DelDOT roads, it's going to be DelDOT requiring the bonds, but, yeah, it's required for street and road improvements, so it's roads, too. That's already in there, but, like I said, the county and county engineering and planning and zoning have been requiring bonding on everything. So, for example, so we've got a bond like what happened in Sea Chase, you know, with the pool house being built or not built.
Still not built.
Sorry I brought it up. So, that's all I had on the subdivision one. I don't know if anybody else had any, or we can move to.
While you're right there, because you're
sure.
The code requires that the finals or the record plan show the cross section of the street. The cross section that we have isn't even close to the cross section and street design standards adopted by the county engineering, and that we, you know, we discussed it a year or so ago.
Yeah.
We need to amend the ordinance to relate to the street design specification of the county engineering.
I thought we did that.
And delete that portion of the requiring a cross section on the final plat.
Yeah. Okay.
So what I'm saying that is that you're showing like 6 inches of slab and 2 courses or 3 courses of bituminous surface treatment, which is tar and chip. And then they've got a swale on each side. Well, you can go out in the field and go to Zachariah's Cove, for example. That's the best example, is that they've got all the swale on one side.
Right.
Because their wetlands on the opposite side. So they elevated away from the wetlands so that the water drains off into the swale next to the lagoon on the opposite side. And it's not a typical cross section. But
right.
The drawing, at that time, we allowed it to be recorded showing that revised.
Right. So just take it all,
not,
so it doesn't have to be shown.
It's not a typical cross section. So I think you're better off taking it off.
Yeah, and that way it just has to comply with upstairs with engineering requirements.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, that just makes sense to me.
Makes sense to me too. Because that ordinance was amended to say that, so it's I guess what Lawrence is saying, it's kind of inconsistent to still.
Well, the thing was a year ago the county engineering adopted new road standards, and our ordinance doesn't reference them.
Yeah.
As amended.
Didn't we say it should say as our current standards?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We talked about it.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That way we don't have to keep changing every time they change, because they've changed it a couple times.
Okay. Well, that's for you guys to figure out.
They'll change it midstream. You can't do that.
Did I hear a voice again? How was your...
Mr. Schrader, yeah, we'd be interested to hear your views on this. If
you'll permit me, I don't ever want to see the engineering office to be able to change standards in the middle of an application. If we accept the principle of law that the application should be processed as the laws and regulations exist at the time of the application, you can't let these guys on the third floor change their minds every time they want to get a new reg to stop somebody.
I think it would public hearing to amend the regs.
Yeah, but nobody knows that. I mean, we've had trouble in the past where they won't tell us how many EDUs there are in a district, and they'll tell you that their SCAP study or whatever it is a guide, but they won't tell you how many are unused. If there's anybody in the building, it's gaming with subdivision or zoning applications. It'll be the engineering office.
I think, though, Mr. Schrader, that ship may have sailed because we went through and took a lot of that stuff, because what was happening is that the subdivision code was completely outdated from what was required, and that's a lot of that's been deleted out already that gives engineering the ability to set the street design standards. So
perhaps the ship should be recalled.
Call it back to port. All right.
There's no defined standard that they can't change.
Yeah.
All right. How about if you put the current standards when the application was filed?
Yeah, and that may be the way to do it. So that eliminates, you know, it being changed midstream. So.
Because they do, Public Works will call me a lot of times and want to know when you got a preliminary approval. And they will allow you to go back to those standards at that time.
Yeah, back to what was in place, right? Anything else on subdivision code? Anyone?
3 lots and 50-foot right-of-way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. We've got that. There was an ordinance that was drafted on. I think Rick did one. And it got, it might be one to pull out of mothballs again just to take a look at.
Well, Jane and I talked about this earlier.
Simplify.
We've been saying, we seem like we talk about it in the office probably every week, every 2 weeks that comes up. Because you got somebody coming in with wants to create a 50-foot right-of-way to create a house in the backyard. And if they were building some kind of standard, it'd be fine. You know, maybe we should create a minor standard or something of that nature if we're going to approve them, but it should probably go to public hearing to create, because people don't know it. The neighbors don't know what's happening. There's no notice. And we approved, I mean, a couple of meetings, pretty much. And there for a while, we stopped. A few years ago, we stopped. We didn't do it. We weren't doing any. And then slowly, it progressively came back. Came back pretty strong last year, probably. But in the last year, and then it sort of tapered off to two or three at a time. But we were getting a substantial number. You see the list on the consent agendas or the other business agendas, and you'd see six or eight time extensions and six or eight three-lot subdivisions or two lots or one lot with a 50-foot access to it. And they're not, and the majority of them don't make any improvements.
Yeah.
They're just creating a driveway to get to that rear lot.
Oh, is it like that one that was in Mike's area not too long ago down off of 24 Millsboro, well, the Rogers.
Right behind the men's garage. Yep.
That road's bad shape. They wanted to add three more lots or whatever. Turned that down, so they had to go to hearing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's when I could pull out that order because it's been talked about.
Well,
I've been here.
We could draft up something, and the commission could discuss it another day and see if we got it.
That's one that needs further discussion. Because if I recall, it got more complicated than it was worth in the prior.
Well, I told Shane today, too. I said, I hate to go to public for a one-lot subdivision. You got the same process to go through for staff, the advertisement, the posting, the staff time, the public hearing. And one day we sat here and had a one-lot subdivision.
Two or three lots.
Some great big commercial application.
Half hour hearing.
Yeah, right.
It was twice as long for that little one lotter because the neighbors didn't like him, I guess, whatever the reason was.
Right.
And it's just, but it's, should we be approving or not?
Yeah. I mean, one way to do it, too, would be that you just notify everybody that's around there and if anybody complains.
Well, we discussed that with the council, and that was one of the options, but that's where it was. They were trying to put that ordinance in that the director had the authority to approve.
Yeah, right on the variance, administrative variance stuff, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, similar to the administrative variance, but it would be a subdivision done the same way.
Yeah. Anyway,
Does the director or the assistant director really want to do that? We'd almost prefer to either not do it or go to public hearing.
Yeah. Yeah.
There goes your postage budget right there.
Yeah, that's right. it's true, but it's just, you send the same notices. You got the same distance no matter.
Yeah, right.
You know, if it's let's say it's near where Rodney lives, we could have four, five, six pages of people notified in 200 feet. Just putting Rodney on notice in case he ever wants advice.
As long as you don't include chickens in my area, you're good. You know, there's a lot more chickens for our people.
But yeah, that Shane and I agree on that. That's still a problem.
And it's like we were talking a while ago. It's the same surveyors, it seems like.
And they send people to us wanting to get them to ask us if it's all right if they apply for it so that they can prepare to work for them.
Yeah.
And it's not suitable a lot of times. Well, the other thing, one more thing on subdivisions. We do a lot of minor subdivisions, not as many as we used to do. We require DLDOT's approval first. So we know that the entrance is acceptable and a location are appropriate for an entrance to serve a lot. And most of them come in, if it's two lots, you get one entrance with a bigger pipe and it's a common driveway. DENREC has come to us several times and said, you've granted a lot, but the land's not suitable for a septic. Should we not require that we get, by policy or even by ordinance, that we have a septic verification for feasibility before we go grant a lot? So we're creating and recording a lot that may never could be developed.
Yeah, that may be one just to say that they need a DENREC septic feasibility or similar statement before step creating a new lot.
And that's just a minor. Yeah. That's not even counting the one with a 50 foot
access. At least the site evaluation. Because
well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying a permit.
Yeah, right.
Required that.
Septic feasibility, whatever the right word is.
Yeah, right.
Approved site evaluation.
Well, you have to be careful because some people are just setting aside lots for grandchildren or whatever, and they don't want to have a huge cost. But it's not genuine to approve a lot because they think, wow, I got a lot for my grandchild. And then 5 or 7 years later, they go to get it, and they couldn't get septic at the time the lot was approved. So it's not being fair to them either. But maybe just a site evaluation by an approved septic design and that's relatively inexpensive to get.
Don't the site evaluations now expire after 5 years?
No, it's not a permit.
The site evaluations themselves, I believe, now have an expiration date as of...
They do, but they're less expensive to do.
Correct,
And they give an indication of acceptability.
They do.
I mean, the rules change, too. So you never know. And plus, if you required them to get a permit, that also sunsets.
That also expires
so
2 years
that's much more expensive
that.
To get.
Yeah.
Rather than having a soil scientist go out there and just simply put a few soil probes in the ground and check.
The one thing we've seen recently, on almost a regular basis now, the subdivisions have septic. NREC is now requiring their approval for the subdivision to show where there's septic, basically create a bunch of circles, where that septic is available to serve those lots in a whole subdivision. So you've seen all these circles. And typically, some of them have central water, so it doesn't affect the water, so it's not too bad. But when there is a septic and a well, they get some pretty crazy lines. And they've actually taken their septics and put them off-site by creating easement to get to that area for the septic system. Because we have already approved the lot, and that's why they're doing it. Now, in some cases, we get a septic feasibility on a subdivision when we have the public hearing, and then they go to get permits, and the guidelines change, rules change, or whether they just found something in the field that created a different perspective for that septic. They've had to relocate the septic other places. It makes it difficult. But, a lot of people come in and they want to create lots. So when you make, first thing you want to do is make sure your land's suitable for a septic. And we're going to need approval from DLDOT before you can get recordation. So we offer that to them, but we don't require it. We're just telling them they need to make sure the land's suitable before they go offering it for sale. Because wasn't there a real estate issue that was required septic feasibility at one time?
Well, it's by statute. You have to have in the contract that it's contingent on the buyer getting a site evaluation.
But I thought that's still valid.
Yeah.
You're signing a waiver.
Or you're signing a waiver.
Right.
With this.
Yeah. So we grant approval and they've got a waiver. We've approved a lot that's not even suitable in some cases. Mm. At least they got the waiver.
Yeah. Got something.
But I didn't know that was still in effect. I haven't heard anybody talk about it for a couple of years.
No, it still is.
Yeah.
I guess we can move on to the zoning code if you want. Let me hand down. This is the memo that I put out. It's the June 10th one. Some of you may have brought it, but here's copies if you haven't. Starting off on that, and this is in really no particular order, but with the time extension ordinance, this even came up a little bit about RPC site plans. RPCs are sort of brought into the subdivision code, and actually the subdivision code's incorporated into the RPC requirements. And of course, the subdivision code has expiration dates for final site plans. The RPC section of the zoning code doesn't really say anything about expiration. I think they sunset just like a subdivision. If that's a way that we're going to treat them, we probably should say that. However, for the benefit of some of the newer folks on the commission, we'd frequently see a simultaneous application for a change of zone and an RPC, where you go from, say, AR1 to, I'll just give an example of HR with an RPC overlay. HR gives you I think it's 12 units, 12 units an acre. The RPC overlay would bring it down to something like 7 or 8, say, just based on what you could actually build out. So there may be some thought that you don't want to have the RPC site plan expire, because at least that limits the density to what was considered at the time the whole thing was approved.
Yeah, it shouldn't be an overlay then.
Yeah, right.
Should be a zone.
Should be a zone.
We have that issue right now.
Yeah.
It's been a couple of years that it's nothing. We haven't even seen the middle of a plan since.
Right.
What you're saying is the RPC, if they get changed the zone to an RPC and it sunsets, the density of the RPC stays intact forever?
Well, not really the RPC. It's the density of the base zoning. We had one that was, it was a change in zone from AR1, 2 units an acre, to an HR RPC. The HR gets you 12 units an acre. The RPC part, which was the site plan, was probably, 7, 8, or 9 units or something per acre. if you say that the site plan, the RPC part, sunsets after 5 years or 3 years or whatever, you're left then 12 units, you know, potentially on that property. It's gone from the two-unit AR zoning to the 12-unit HR zoning with nothing limiting what you could put on it, you know. So that may be why, you know, you don't necessarily want an RPC site plan to expire. I don't know.
Unless there's some way to put a condition of the overlay for the RPC
that
that's only valid for so long until the project's substantially underway.
Yeah, for the whole
whole
zoning and everything. Yeah.
But you go back to the old way, you do a rezoning to the MR.
Right.
And then you apply for a rezoning to the RPC. We used to do them separate.
Right.
You went through a public hearing process today for the RP, for the zoning, MR. And you come back in and advertise it again, you come back in 6-8 weeks from now to do an RPC, which seems stupid to do it.
Yeah, I almost got to have the same thing.
But you could do it simultaneously on two different applications. So you know what your underlying zoning is, and then you get the RPC as separate.
Right.
So you got changes in 1900, 1901.
Yeah.
Does the same thing, but you could retain one and lose the other because it's an overlay.
Like I said, that's, you know,
confusing,
one.
But
yeah,
there's quite a few of them.
There's quite a few, yeah. Because everybody just looks at it at one project. All right, I'm looking at 8 units an acre. Well, you know, if they keep it. If they keep it. But if the site plan voids out, it's 12 units an acre. You know, so that's where we need to look at that to decide how that goes. And again, that may be one we got to bring back and, you know, really think about what we want to do. But I just sort of throw that out there for discussion.
And you had the numbers right too, because that was it was around 8.
Yeah.
By the rezoning with the conditional use, or not with the RPC, but if the RPC is void for lack of development, then they retain their zoning, so the HR stays.
Yeah.
At 12.
Yeah. Section 115-4 is the definitions, and there may be some that Lawrence and Shane have. A couple that I thought of. Or looking through was the definition of filling station. That sort of seems like, you know, the Gomer Pyle filling station of the Mayberry RFD that nobody actually does anymore, you know, when really it's now convenience stores. And we may want to add some language in there that talks about what, you know, we really have anymore. Because that comes up in the B1 district and some other places. You know,
I think
where
the differentiating factor there is gas pumps.
Yeah.
The existence, presence, or absence of gas pumps. I don't care what you call it. The other one would be a convenience store.
Yeah.
What you're saying.
Either one. A convenience store could have gas pumps. Yeah. Sure. You can have a convenience store without pumps. I guess you could have pumps without a convenience store if you had one of those automated filling.
I'll look at this.
You know.
Okay.
We've got a Carries and Harrow.
Yeah. Right.
Filling station.
Right. And there's just not many of those left.
Yeah. So that's one.
They're going well.
Yeah. Right.
There's no service stations. There's one in Laurel. Go to Carries, man. The guys are going great.
Yeah.
They do the windshield and check the tires and everything.
There's a few, not too many.
So anyway, that's one. I mean, that's a fairly easy fix. But
there may be a couple other definitions that really need to be just reviewed.
Right. Well, we should look. Yeah,
they're not
look
current.
Yeah. That's like I said. I didn't go through all of them.
We just did the garage studio apartment, so that's pretty clean. We haven't really had, I think we've had two that went to the board since that was adopted in 08. Something else that you could look at just in your mind. Okay, just think about it. Home occupation.
Yeah, that's one that.
It's a little short list. There's a lot, and I have to do. I do a lot of things with a home occupation. I have to approve based on, and it's pretty wide open in some things. For example, a gunsmith. I don't know how many gunsmiths I got in Southern County. That's an art, as much as it is a trade. Part-time is not a full-time thing, so they're granted. And then the FFL guy comes after me and questions why I'm approving them sometimes. So we have to deal with them once in a while, but they haven't been real negative. That's just one example of an issue that I get into. Gunsmithing, the arts and craft guy that builds crafts and takes them to the Dell Tech for the show and sells them at the show. He could also sell them at home if he built it at home. And then you can ride around in Sussex County and see guys building sheds, picnic tables. The guy on Route 9 sells picnic tables. He does it. I mean, he just builds them in his garage and then sells them. Puts one in the yard and sells it or hauls it to a show somewhere. Is that going too far, you know, with the home occupation? Or could we expand upon it? We've had a lot of people, you can't have any employees.
Right.
A lot of home occupation lists there, but you can't have any employees. Is there a way to do an expandable home occupation or do an expandable home occupation and maybe go to the Board of Adjustment to allow for that employee?
Because right now what happens is if they have an employee, that automatically puts it in the conditional use process.
That's the conditional use, right.
Barbershops, lawnmower services.
Well, barbershops are listed.
The gravestone place, you know. Yeah.
Okay, this is one, I'm not trying to be smart or anything, but practice of cosmetology or barbering, which would be at a beauty shop or the barbershop. And then what a massage parlor wants to do the same. If that's all they're doing and there are no employees, it's really no different.
But isn't that covered, Lawrence, by the beginning part of that section where it says includes but is not limited to the following?
Oh, it is. It's covered, but it just gets to the point where I get people asking for some crazy stuff. I won't get into the definition of what they define personal services. We've had that question a couple of times. Seriously.
It has to be legal.
Are they licensed?
It has to be legal.
Yeah.
But it falls in that same basic thing, cosmetology, barbering. You know, but then you get the professional office for the physician, the dentist, the lawyer. How many of them actually practice
by themselves?
Doctor, dentist, lawyer practices, but like that, and a nurse there or an employee.
Yeah, you can't.
Right. No, maybe an architect, and you know, an accountant or a salesman, but certainly not a physician or I don't know too many lawyers that work by themselves.
Bill Wilgus, staff. I think used to. He's the last one I know about. He may still, but yeah.
And we've had questions about the private instruction being your music teacher and you give lessons and you can only have one, or it says one or two pupils at a time. How they practice for a concert type thing. They go somewhere else, I guess. Daycare centers is defined in another place, and the thing we get into there, almost every week I do a daycare license because the licensing bureau won't grant their license unless they've got a letter from us saying that their daycare center approved, and I have to tell them how many kids they can have as far as definition, which mm-hmm. is six plus two school-age children for 2 hours a day, that type of thing. And that's just some examples. And then it says what's not to be considered, and maybe the not to be considered where there could be some interpretation added to keep it up a little bit.
Yeah, okay. The next one is golf courses. This is one that's kind of Lawrence and I have been talking about lately, because golf course, the definition doesn't fit what people are doing. I mean, it talks about, where is it? Well, it's actually in the zoning code. It's essentially, here it goes. Golf courses not lighted for night play, not including miniature golf courses, putting greens or driving ranges, and similar activities operate as business, but including a building for a golf pro shop, locker room, and snack bar as an accessory use. Et cetera. You know, I mean, every golf course in Sussex County and everywhere, I mean, they have, you know, big dining facilities, convention facilities, restaurants, bars, you know, the whole deal. And we've approved them and they're
there. We've talked about that for years.
Yeah.
And it just, big snack bar.
Yeah.
That's
a giant.
Is that a problem or is it just, I mean, or is it?
Well, it's come up in an issue recently, and the example is one golf course has applied for a liquor license to be able to sell off-premises liquor. In other words, they'd be able to sell to their members or whomever was using the course for off-site consumption, not the beer cart. You know, you get in your car with your bag or your six-pack, and you go home and you drink it, you know, like a liquor store. And as part of that license process, they need to get, like Lawrence was just saying on the other one, a letter from planning and zoning says that this is zoned for this particular use. And you start looking at it and you go, well, you know, really, really? Not really. Right. So it kind of gets you in a jam.
Well, the concern in talking to the commissioner was that it then creates a conflict between the distance requirement between liquor stores.
Yeah, right.
Or off-premise sales.
Right. You know, so what you end up with in that case is you end up with basically a golf course operating as a liquor store that would prohibit a liquor store from opening in a C1 or B1 zoned area, which is appropriate for a liquor store, you know, from the distance requirements.
But their license is out sales. It's not, they're not really getting a license to sell liquor at the golf course.
They are, yeah. That's what, to get your wild turkey and get in your car and go drink it at home, yeah, or whatever. Yeah.
Well, what do they want that for?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's to boost revenues.
It started in Newcastle, and several of them in Newcastle do it.
Nobody in Sussex does.
Now they're trying to do it in Sussex. Yeah. I still haven't answered that letter yet.
Yeah. I haven't heard anything.
Somebody probably got cited because somebody walked out with a drink and got in their car and drove home. And that's when off sale.
Yeah.
It's an off-site sale.
Well, they're talking about the bottle.
Yeah,
selling the
bottle. Wanting to sell the bottle, not just send them. Not give. You can buy. You go into the bar and get a. You go into the bar and get a drink, and it's your choice if you walk out with it. You ask for it to go cup. They give it to you a go cup. So you go out and then you have a problem out on the streets, and they want to know where you got it.
I honestly don't know why any golf course would want it. Just from the liability.
I won't say what I said to them. They're trying to sell the bottle, or a six-pack or whatever.
Yeah, just like a liquor store.
Huh. So. Rather than have to leave the development and ride into town to get the bottle and come back.
Yeah.
Get every dirt.
This one happens to be a golf course that's in a development.
Yeah, which most of them are,
right.
Pretty much.
And the thing is, I mean, we're kind of getting off track a little bit, but the license would be, the DABC's license would be to members. However, the DABC considers anybody basically at that facility at any time as a member for their purposes. It's different from the club membership. So if you're there
it's
for...
actually member or guest. They said guest, member and guest.
Yeah, and they even said if it was a charity golf tournament where you got, you know, a zillion people out there, anybody who's there could, you know, buy. So anyway, but that's where that came up because it's not... You can't say it's necessarily permitted under the code because the code doesn't even talk about really restaurants, you know, or bars or anything. So,
but that would be a house cleaning on the golf course reference just to bring it to what they really are. Rather than a snack bar, they have a restaurant and convention facility. If it's there, they got everything else they have. The only other thing that they have that's not referenced is almost every golf course has a putting green and a driving range. They're not lighted. That would be the one thing that should be restricted, especially in a community. It shouldn't be allowed to be lighted as far as...
Yeah.
Right. They have a course in Myrtle Beach that the whole course is lighted. They can play it at night.
Yeah.
We don't need those guys, do we?
I don't think so, yeah.
You might.
Not me.
I don't.
You can just use glow-in-the-dark golf balls. The next one is this one. I know Marty and I have talked about this one a little bit. It's come up. There's the big box limitations. The B1 district can't have any building or group of buildings that exceeds 75,000 square feet in B1 at all because it's neighborhood business. You want smaller stuff. In the C1 and CR1 zones, for example, you can have it, but if you exceed 75,000 square feet, it triggers additional requirements for parking and stuff like that. The problem is, and we've actually had one applicant and his representative who might have been here earlier who said, well, you know, that's fine, I'll just subdivide it, and each parcel is going to have less than 75,000 square feet, and we get around it through that.
Like they did on 24.
Yeah, well, that was the one that I know Marty and I had talked about. You know, we know what the intent of it is, but it doesn't clearly say this is how you got to treat it. I mean, it'll probably take some wording to do it, but it strikes me that if there's a common development scheme or if there's like a merger by use, in other words, it's subdivided, but if you look at it, it's all one parking lot that serves the whole place. In that case, whether it's all separate lots or different titles or whatever, you should, you know, still be bound by the 75,000 square foot requirements.
Because they're going to be sharing stormwater management ponds and
everything.
Sharing all those.
What would you do in that case prior to subdivision?
What do you mean?
Prior to splitting the property, they would have a certain size parcel and they're only allowed 75,000 square foot.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's always going to be ways around it. I mean, you could, if you plan 3 years in advance that you're going to do this, you could subdivide it. But at the same time, I think we can really try to close it up so that you're not getting a site plan, or you're not getting your, like, your rezoning on that property on 24. You're not getting it changed to B1 as one big piece, and then come in at the site plan time and have it subdivided into three separate parcels, you know, so you can get around the...
And in the Route 24 application, the applicant was pretty honest about what he wanted to do.
Right.
And he had also committed to the big box requirements in advance. He said, we're planning for that. By the time we get done, we will be within the big box requirement regs anyway. So it was straightforward. So, I mean, I compliment that application for being genuine, number one. And number two, anticipating meeting those requirements, but not everybody may be that honest. And I don't see why we can't treat it like we do, minor subdivisions. You're allowed so many, and then if you exceed that in a tax parcel, then it triggers a major subdivision application. And so once a property comes in and it's the commercial zone is pulled out of a parcel, if it's part or all, then that would trigger that, hey, this big box warning goes on your parcel. You know, as long as you don't exceed the 75,000, you're good. But if you do, then this other one comes in and you're gonna have to meet those requirements on a property parcel by parcel basis. You can't obviously restrict different property owners in different tax parcels and join them because they're not connected. There's no nexus there. So I don't see why we couldn't take a look at it from a perspective of just looking at a parcel. If part of it's zone commercial, fine, no problem, but we're gonna put a tag on that whole parcel as it was. And if you ever go over the 75,000, then this is what's gonna happen. The property owner knows it straight up going in. So it's not like you get blindsided or change rules after the fact.
Where would you put that addendum?
The same as I don't know how we track the minor subdivisions, but you know, the same as we do that you know, we should be able to, you know, obviously every one of our tax parcels, if you look at my tax bill, I can tell, you know, -01-02, how many times I've subdivided a parcel in this something. So we could come up with a system that, you know, is not burdensome, but I think it's important that the property owner know that they're headed down this path in advance, not get blindsided on the tail end. And I think they need to know that these requirements are in there, and that's going to be a flag for them, just like people with minor subdivisions. If they know the rules and they see that -01-02-03, they go, oh my gosh, I've got to do something here. You know?
I mean, it's come up time and again. It just strikes me that one way or another, we've got to address it, because it's just a gaping loophole in the system. Because, you know, if I had to defend it, if on that Route 24 and they came in and we tried to deny it because it was subdivided into three separate parcels with three separate owners, you know, separate LLCs with all the same members, there's no way I could say, you know, that it's indefensible. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, that's happened to us twice on 24.
Yeah.
Well, then I think we've been fortunate the way it's happened. I mean, people haven't been dishonest about it or tried to hoodwink anybody. But at some point, somebody's going to come in and look at that loophole and say, you know, hey, wow, look what I can do. And that's just not, you know, we need to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Well, and I'll jump past one on this memo has to do with the big box. One of the things in the CR1 district, I guess, and the old C1, is if you exceed 75,000 square feet, you can. But if you do, you got to have, for example, 20% increase in parking for, you know, the fact that you've exceeded the 75,000 square feet. And that's been, I think, one of the reasons people have subdivided stuff, because they don't want to comply with that. And that may be something that we look at eliminating, because, you know, in too many situations, we end up with ginormous parking lots that don't have anybody parked in them except for big car shows and boat shows.
Global warming contributor, we like all that Kmart.
Yeah, Kmart. you know, so there may be a way around that. It would be, you know, that, you know, it reverts back to just the straight parking requirements that would apply based on square footage anyway, you know, that are in the code. You know,
you do get to an extreme sometime. That what you were using as example is prime, because that's a big building.
Yeah,
it's almost all retail, and it's all based on the calculation, and they use about 1/10 of the parking lot.
Right, right. It just doesn't make any sense. You know?
But is that more
20%er?
That was,
Kmart was not a 20 percenter.
Basically, Kmart was, it was just all set as retail, whole building.
So you end up with that much parking.
Very leasable area probably, because it's got three different users, or what, back then it was a pizza place and Kmart.
Another example that comes to mind, I don't know if anybody recognizes this, but is Rehoboth Mall. If you go out the back entrance onto Route 24, there is probably, I don't know if it's 50 or 100 spaces along the entrance road that nobody ever parks in, but they had to build it.
Mostly employees.
Yeah, because it was big box.
Worth revisiting all of our parking regulations, because, for instance, our requirements for medical do not reflect the way that those offices are used
today.
True. You know,
that's grossly under.
Yeah, it's way undersized. Yeah. And I think that the big box thing to require more parking is not appropriate, because they don't use the parking they have now.
Right.
But if you look at Walmart in contrast to Kmart, you know, the Walmart parking lot, it's not unusual for it to be jammed up, depending upon the time of day. You know, so some places, you know, the parking is greatly underutilized simply because of the economy or the nature of the business. But then you take someone else who's a high-volume dealer, and they're constantly using those parking spaces.
But the difference is that's true with what you see, but because I had to deal with this with John Sergovic, I don't know, it seems like 8 years ago now. That's true, but at the same time, Walmart's part of the overall Rehoboth Mall parking requirements, and there's parking spaces all over that site that aren't used. I mean, it's tons of impervious areas over by the Rite Aid, and then, like I was saying, back behind it and off on the side where they had to just build parking lots, you know, that nobody uses. You're right, because out front's jammed up, but then there's all kinds of impervious areas that are
Kmart's a poor example for the last many years, because it's really not, doesn't it?
Yeah, right.
Business.
How did you arrive at the spot number of spots originally in Lawrence?
That one's so old, it was probably 1.5 spaces per 1,000 square foot gross leasable area.
Yeah.
What do you think, Shane? Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. Right.
That's a big building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's like, I mean, a few times you go to even here at BJ's in Millsboro or whatever, and Lowe's, you know, they're side by side, and a third of that parking lot, when they're busy, is full, and the whole back space is open. That's a lot of blacktop and expense. And plus, you know, it'd be better grass or trees or something than blacktop, I would think. You know, it's a waste on all accounts. You know, it's not needed.
Yeah. I don't know what the specs are in Millsboro. That's in town, but.
I mean, one way to look at it would...
And sometimes it's looks empty compared to them. They have maybe, when they're really busy, probably a third to a half of the space that may be occupied.
And plus, if
but there are employees out there, too.
If it was full, you'd need a dark bus to get up there, because it's a mile away.
If you go there early, you'll notice a lot of cars out at the front where the driveway comes across in front of that dialysis center they've just finished.
Yeah.
They're employees.
Right.
Mm.
On the low side. I'm not sure about
that. You have to park in the back of the lot and walk up. Right.
One way to maybe do it would be, and this I just threw this out, you know, and we may need to adjust the base parking requirements, and say that you could do like the shared parking analysis, you know, something like that to show, okay, I'm building this. This is what my actual parking is going to be based on established standards, you know, or default to the county's requirements. You know, that way, you know, if they come in with a parking study based on established standards for this particular use, and they can justify it, and we'll say, all right, you know, that works.
It's a good idea.
You know, so, I mean, because we've got that set up, you know, the standard set up for the shared parking analysis that people have to do if they want to, you know, sort of combine different uses to mitigate their parking requirements. So that may be one way to approach that. But it just strikes me that may kill two birds with one stone. It may eliminate all this impervious area, and it also may eliminate the need for people to start subdividing properties to get around the parking requirements.
Exactly.
So, anyway. I can take a look at both of those.
Major arterial.
Yeah, this one came up sort of the general topic did anyway in the LT things, yeah. And all I'm suggesting at this point on that is just make sure, I don't know that Section 99.5 of the code is consistent with what Delta considers a major arterial roadway, and I'm not sure that necessarily either one of them are consistent with the comp plan. You know, if we're going to have a definition in the code and list specific roadways, we need to make sure that it all meshes right.
Yeah.
We went through this a few years back when DelDOT changed their whole wording of what each different road type was.
Right.
And I don't know if it conforms to theirs now. We'd have to, I can get some directive from DelDOT and see what they're recalling each word based, or each description based on ours.
Right.
And we may have to amend or they may leave them alone.
Yeah, but it's just something that we need to look at just so everything, like I said, meshes right. Section 115-129, this to me is just a housekeeping one. With, again, going back to RPCs, talks about completion guarantees. That's the bonding. It says that they may be required. Strikes me that that should be mandatory. We require them for subdivisions and everything else. We should make sure it just says, period, you got to have it for RPCs. That way there's no question. Next one was parking in the front yard setbacks. Mr. Johnson, I'm sure, has an interest in this one. But the code, when you go through it, it actually talks about that. I think, Shane, you and I have talked about this, really only in home occupations. Mm-hmm. There's not any place else that says specifically you can't park. That's been, since Mr. Allen and every other county attorney, Lawrence and Shane, I think, have sort of always, that's been the policy, but it's not necessarily in the code. So, you know, it strikes me that it's not a big deal because it's what the commission's been imposing, or at least questioning, and in the parking section of the code, there's that fallback that says that the commission has the ability to modify this if, you know, reasons warrant. In other words, if every other property's got parking in the front yard setback, the commission has the discretion to say, well, it's not fair to say, you know, you're the only one that can't, so to speak. So, but again, it's kind of one of those things, whenever it comes up, me and Shane and Lawrence kind of, you know, look through the code and roll our eyes and say, well, it's not really there. So,
well, hey, what if we put,
says it shall be discouraged.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, we put the front 20 foot be landscaped, period. But they could park or they could have a driveway on the inside of that 20 foot.
Yeah.
So right now you could have 20 foot and a driveway within the parking. So they could do it in either way or in reverse. Just have the 20 foot landscaping out front.
Well, there's a couple reasons why parking in the front yard setback bothers me. One is for future planning. You know, if we're allowing these buildings to be built, and then you're allowing the parking in the front yard setback, then you're going to wind up with a situation where there's no room to expand the road. You know, if you got a two-lane road and you need a turn lane, and where are you going to come up with that land for that extra turn lane, or to turn it into four lanes. So, and 24 is a classic example, because where's there going to be room to expand 24 into a four lane highway if it needs to be expanded, if we're allowing parking right on top of the road? That's one of my concerns, is looking into the future for road expansions. And obviously, with Plantations Road, that's a major problem, you know, with the way the development was allowed to occur there. The second issue for me with parking in the front yard setback is then it just creates this massive congestion right up against the road, which, you know, visually is ugly, you know, and takes away from the, you know, the beauty of our county. So that's why it's causes me a lot of agitation.
Well, the one that was a good example, the issue of the closeness to the road. The subdivisions along Route 1 Oceanside were approved with all interior access, so all the lots had to come in from the interior street. And they were allowed to put in 10 or 20 foot landscape strips along one to buffer them from one more than to buffer one from them.
Right.
And then they would have their lot line would be 10 or 20 foot from the right of way of the road. Of course, it's already dualized, so that's not as much trouble as like 24. So, and then the plantation thing came up, and they submitted the same concept and got approval without us even barely thinking about it, because it came up about the same time. So they end up with a 50-foot right-of-way with a 10 or 20-foot landscape strip, and then there's a unit sitting there, because they were multifamily, or maybe 10 more foot. But 20 or 30 foot from the edge of the road is where the unit is. And again, you can't expand. There's no way to expand. The other side, on the western side, there's a little bit more room because they were set back. They were multifamily, but their front yard was considered plantation road as far as the full property had a setback all the way down that side. So they got more setback on that side. That's what happened at plantation road. And that's probably the last time that happened as far as on a regular general local road, other than Route 1. Right. Route 1, it worked, but it didn't affect anybody else except the land between the Route 1 and the ocean, so it wasn't too bad.
Then we can have the same problem with Route 9 eventually. You know, it's with the quasi-commercialization that's happening along there, that, you know, if there's a need for expansion, where are they going to go?
Well, we already saw that on the one commercial rezone we just had, Seashore Associates. Yeah, they said that they were sort of boxed in by, you know, parking and Route 9 requirements. So they needed, that's why they justified the rezoning.
Well, theirs is more by location of the building, the way
the whole configuration.
Not so much from DLDOT requirements, but just from the existing structure that they do have.
Yeah. All right, well, that seems like that's one at least to look at. The next one isn't a change. It was just I was going through it. It sort of brings up a point. There's Article 24 of the Zoning Code deals with specific conditional uses. You know, I think there's borrow pits in there. I think it talks about mobile home parks or whatever they're now called, et cetera. You know, the only thing that I'm pointing out on that is it's kind of even like, you know, the subdivision code. The more you have a checklist, the more you're boxed into an approval potentially if somebody checks off the checklist. You know, I'm not saying we get rid of them, but, you know, I just point out that we probably shouldn't start many checklists unless we know, you know, that's what it is we want to do.
Unless you added an additional line, the additional requirements could be imposed.
Yeah.
Through the public hearing process, which they always are.
Yeah.
But we looked at some of the conditional use references when you go through each zoning district. And you've heard me say this one before, there's one in there that says a poultry house on less than 5 acres requires a conditional use. But just, that's an obvious variance rather than a conditional use. So that should be, if you look at each one of those line items in that list of conditional use in each district, you're gonna say a couple of them could be reversed over or transferred over to the board. We haven't had a conditional use for a chicken house less than 5 acres now for 20 years, maybe, Shane, probably. We had a lot for a while, but they were coming in with a chicken house on 2 acres, 3 acres.
For mortgage purposes, right?
And they weren't as big as they are today. They weren't the massive houses that they're building today. There's a couple little things we could probably tweak out and either transfer them or just take them out. That one could be struck because it's a variance if you wanted to build on less than 5 acres.
Right, true.
Yeah. That'd be a simple fix on that. And that's my quick example on that.
Okay.
I don't know if there's anything else in there that's specific or not. Most of them all have lists, though. It's like
I know. And I wasn't suggesting we change it. It was just sort of a point.
They were set up to have a list because the other items were listed in each zoning category.
Yeah.
But if you went to AR, real quick here, conditional use list, is a couple pages.
Right.
With
a catch-all.
Actually, 3.5. With a catch-all.
Yeah, so, right.
And the conditional use is relate to agriculture, that's fine. Commercial aquariums, airports, biotech campuses, and we've only had one of those, beaches, biotech industry, cemetery, circus, or carnival ground. That could be that's a temporary thing. It could be, unless it's a amusement park, could be. Go to the board.
Okay.
They do cell towers. They can do heliports and airports too, couldn't they? Big problem. Where's the other one? Livestock auctions. That's agriculture.
Heliports. That's good.
I don't see the poultry house anymore. Am I missing it? I don't see it. Oh, here it is. Structures for commercial poultry raising on farms less than 5 acres.
Yeah, we could just strike that one. That should be a variance. That's a straight variance. Yeah, okay.
That's a big quick example. That's one always sticks in my mind. But then again, there are special exceptions that the commission and council might say, well, that should probably be something we review and not the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'll talk to the board later and see.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably
a whole bunch of stuff they want to give back to you.
Right.
Because we probably gave it to them a few years back.
Toss it back.
While we're on 115, 179.
Sure.
Does sea create a problem for sports at the beach?
Let's see. Hold on.
I don't know if they're within the airport approach zone.
They are. Part of their site is.
Yeah.
That site's protected pretty much.
Yeah, it is. With site plans going way back on that before it was even sports at the beach or even owned by the same people.
Right. But, and I mean, just the way that's written, I wonder if they should even be there.
Well, when you look at the airport approach zones, it's mapped on the site plans, and there's things that aren't built and weren't allowed to be built in that approach zone. I mean, it's clearly marked.
Okay.
I mean, going back 15 years on site plans, because we had to go through that. They were trying to build concession stands and gyms and other stuff that they were told they couldn't.
They still try. They still come back to us.
Yeah. So
they went to the board last time so they could put up what appeared to be Ghost Town, is that what it was, Shane?
Yes.
Sort of like you go to Frontier Town, they've got these fake buildings, fake walls, like walls, and uh-huh. They look like you're inside of a complex, but you're really not. So they can put up their Halloween entertainment, like lighted stuff.
Like Fright Night or whatever it was, or whatever up in you guys. Nice. They also wanted to do just, the Christmas light display, like in Ocean City. Which it was decided that would be compatible with the lighting for an airport runway at nighttime when you got all kinds of Christmas.
Actually got approved.
Did it really? Jeez.
Yeah. Board approved it with the okay from the airport management and FAA because they were going to place it away from, from the airport.
So when you go through the tunnel that lights up consecutively, at night, you have people landing on the EOC building.
I think they decided not to do that.
Yeah, that's what I did.
The cost of the rent,
right,
the
right.
Lighting was just astronomical. It was going to cost them for 10 days of nighttime activities.
The next one, talking about 179, is 179B. This is one that I don't know that, anybody's really latched onto or noticed, but it talks about that any public, semi-public, or public service buildings can be erected up to a height not exceeding 60 feet. So that really bumps up your height limit from what otherwise is permitted, in your base zoning. And I always read that to think it meant like hospitals or, public service type buildings, or even like public utility buildings or something, that had a special need. But when you read the definition of public, it's just if the public's allowed to be inside it, So, I mean, that means hotels, restaurants, theoretically anything, it automatically goes up to 60 feet. That's something that, granted, that's sort of a policy issue, but it seems like that may be something we need to look at, changing either the definition of public or making this apply to, more public service buildings and taking out the reference to public or semi-public from that.
We had that issue came up with the project on Route 9.
Vineyards.
About, and we got into quite a discussion on the height of the building that's allowed.
Yeah. I mean, because even a shopping mall, that's a public building. I mean, you could.
Right.
I'm not saying it's wrong, but, I don't know that that's what that was intended to allow.
It wasn't the intent.
Yeah.
Well, and that might be resolved simply by putting the wording in there after semi-public or public service buildings, after that comma, would be such as.
Yeah.
Yeah, including but not limited to. Yeah.
Right.
At some point, we probably need to revisit the whole height issue, but that's a.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, it's another day.
We'll let Dewey Beach take care of that.
There you go.
Only if you're drinking.
All right. The next one, this is truly.
That's a correction. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a correction. That just was left out of that one, the Highway Corridor Overlay Zone. It just didn't list it when that zoning district was created. This one, the next one, is the Environmentally Sensitive Development District Overlay Zone. it requires the The Planning and Zoning Commission shall make a determination as to whether adequate information has been presented for the project to proceed, and that's the environmental study and environmental impact report. I forget exactly the wording for it. But we've had on subdivision applications, people question whether there should have been a preliminary finding first that adequate information has been submitted before the hearing's even scheduled. You know, and admittedly, the way it's worded, you know, you could argue that that's the case. It strikes me that it's a fairly easy fix just to replace the word proceed to say that the Planning and Zoning Commission shall make a determination as to whether adequate information has been presented for the project to be approved. You know, I don't know that the commission necessarily wants to have a preliminary hearing on the information and say, okay, you can proceed, and then have the public hearing, you know, 6 months
turn
down the road.
Yeah. And turn it down in the public hearing.
Yeah, yeah. So I bring that up because I know it's come up, you know, where people say, well, did they submit their information, and did you determine that it was okay for them to proceed to the public hearing? You know, and that's kind of what it suggests in that code. I mean, I think it's just something that should be cleaned up to eliminate that question. Unless anybody has any objections to that, I think I'll go ahead and roll on that one. All right. And that's all I had.
Okay. Lawrence, you or Shane have anything else you wanted to add?
The we discussed early on in the very beginning RPCs, and it needs to be similar to a subdivision approval. I think if you establish a time limit from when they get approval by council or the master plan, whichever, but there's got to be some time in there where they've got to submit to us a preliminary plan.
Yeah.
Then they get the preliminary plan or the master plan, whichever you call it. Then they have so much time to get us a final. Then they get so much time to be substantially underway. So really you got almost three steps in that process because it's different from the subdivision process. But we got some projects right now that I could say they're void, but I had to bring them before the commission to say for you to determine that they're void. We've done that in the past.
Because there's no set time limit, I guess.
Set time.
Yeah.
It's not clear.
Right.
And that comes up quite a bit.
We should clear that up.
And I don't know what that time limit should be. It should dovetail right into the subdivision ordinance.
Yeah, I mean, because it does reference the subdivision ordinance, so that would be the best
thing. Do you do it at the time of the council's action? Because the ordinance does reference the master plan, which is they can record as a preliminary plan. They just can't use it for sale purposes. It's just recorded. They basically take their preliminary plan, put all the notes on it, all the conditions of approval, and then they can record it.
Right.
But they need a time from that point to get substantial underway. Just like, and it does refer to the subdivision ordinance. So we tell people that sometimes, not every time probably, that they're basically falling under the floor, but it's not clear.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
It really needs to be cleared up.
Yeah. And that way you've got some basis for telling people that.
We talked about clusters, we talked about golf courses. There's a couple issues with signs that I'll probably be addressing the board. The board sees more about signs than the commission does. Just so you know, there's an in the ordinance there's a reference that says you can have 150 square foot per building.
Right.
But there's also a section in there that says, and we adopted it, and the council adopted it, that says you can have 15% of a wall area. So we're getting some of the sign people saying, well, that meant the building. I said, no, it doesn't say the building. It doesn't say walls. It says a wall. So how far do you carry it? So that's one question. But they could take that 150 and sort of wrap it around the building and different signs on different sides if they so chose. As far as I'm concerned, they could. But that needs, we just need to make sure. But that 15% is a killer. The example would be, and the example that we used back in the discussions of the before we adopted the ordinance was Super G on Route 1. Their building faces south, it doesn't face Route 1. But their loading dock for two truck loading spaces is on the Route 1 side, but there's this great big gigantic wall that doesn't have anything on it. And 15% of that wall would be a substantial sign, but it probably wouldn't look that big because the wall is so big. Take a standard store with 150%, that's not too bad. And it'll probably be close to being the same. So we're just concerned that some of the interpretation, maybe we need to address the way it's written, because it sounds like you could possibly move that 15% around more than one wall. And I'm saying, I'm arguing that it says a wall. A wall doesn't mean four sides, it's that one wall.
Sign, facade, or whatever.
And you don't calculate the window, you don't calculate the door, you count the wall. That's wall space. That's really, we're getting more technical. Another issue related to signs, and you're seeing them all the time. You get a lot of complaints, and the inspectors don't know what to do, and we haven't really had much really good direction of what to do with them other than address it in the ordinance. It's feather flags. They look like a feather, but...
Yeah.
And we've said if they're just a feather flag with nothing on it, just a color, we're not worried about it. If it's got a word on it, or a logo, then it's a violation because it's a sign. And the difficulty is, how many years have people had flags on the front of their property that says welcome or open?
Yeah.
And now they're putting them on feather flags. So they're bigger, they're right out, and they stick them right out the edge of the road. They're somewhat distracting, but they're not to some people at all. So we need, that probably needs to be addressed in the code.
One of the notes I had, and this may not be, was what do you do with the like the motor vehicle that's a van where somebody takes, you know, a sign and fix it to the motor vehicle. It's parked in Mr. Johnson's, you know, parking in the front yard setback, or it's a bed sheet that they throw over the thing. Is that treated like a renegade sign?
It's addressed in the ordinance right now. It's really difficult to enforce because the magistrate has thrown several of them out in court. The example would be it references parking for the purpose of advertising. So the sleepies, just using sleepies for example, I'm not saying sleepies is the one. Sleepies decides to park their state body truck out to the front, in the front parking lot.
Right.
Okay. But it's there intentionally to advertise for sleepies. Because sleepy signs back on the building, facing the road, not facing where you can see it from a distance.
Yeah.
We had a motel, a baker that was in an old motel building that parked his old junk vehicle that wasn't even drivable, had a sign on it. It sat out there for quite a while. We took him to court and lost. So if you're going to address it, we need to address it more specifically so that it's clear as what you can and cannot do. He was parked in a parking space. If he parked in the grass, then there might have been, we probably could have handled it, but he was parked in a parking space. So we've had three or four we lost in court. It's been several years since we even tried it, but we have. We've lost several in court, but we've won a couple too over parking for a purpose of advertising.
What's the harm?
I'm not saying that there is, but I'm just, that's what the code says. So you take it out or you tweak it.
I think one thing you've got to, maybe if you're going to leave it in, it's got to be an operable vehicle. You know, that would be at least.
Well, the thing was that the one thing about the example I used first was the state body truck. The state body truck's bigger than the parking space. So technically he was obstructing not only the view or whatever, but he's also taking up more than a parking space. He's taking up part of the driveway.
I don't know how you'd ever enforce that. All somebody's going to do is come in and testify and say, well, I just park there. You know,
yeah,
park
wherever I want. And that's what he said. Instead of ever being vandalized to the rear of the building, and it wasn't sleepies, but I just used sleepies for a reference because I don't remember the title of the other company, but their vehicle was being vandalized, parked in the back of the Super Fresh Shopping Center.
Right.
So they parked it out front where there's more traffic, more visibility. But they're also advertised.
Well, that's a good example. You're talking about the grocery store. I mean, if you go down to Rehoboth and you got Super G, you have all these trailers lined up right by the road. I mean, they don't have the tractor hooked up to them. They're just, those trailers are parked there, and they got the great big signs of Super G, and it's not there because of vandalism or anything else. It's there because it creates multiple signs, so someone sees that rather than Super Fresh. You know, so
that's right.
I mean, that they're there all the time. I'm not.
And they've been cited for parking because they're actually parked in parking spaces.
Right.
They're actually taking up six or eight parking spaces because they're parking across them rather than.
You can still pull up though, Nick.
Reduce the number of parking spaces. They wouldn't have them.
It could be nowhere parks out there. Sure.
That's the third benefit of
the party. The thing is, when you go to that site, there's two loading docks on that wall that I referenced in the front that run parallel to one. you go around the corner of the building next to the WSFS, and there's either two or four loading docks there, and there's fairly seldom ever a tractor trailer there because they want that open for that other tractor trailer that's coming.
Yeah, it really has food on it.
And they're full of summer paraphernalia is what they're full of, probably.
Yeah.
One other thing that was brought recently, and I'd had it down, but they reminded me of it today, actually. We have some issues with vendors. We've been requiring them to go to conditional use. Example, the hot dog guy at Lowe's would be an example. He's got his little trailer that's fixed up into a little kitchenette thing with a refrigeration unit and a little grill, and he sells hot dogs. That's just one example. We had public hearing for that at Lowe's, conditional use. We had public hearings at the outlets behind Applebee's. We had, they proposed three different locations on that site to use it for vendors. We went to the Nike side on the opposite side of the road, and they had two on that side they wanted to put vendors. Sounds like a board of adjustment to me.
It's not really a
land use.
Again, it's too much parking. They want to do something with all that parking.
I know. I'm just saying, but it was for an outside vendor to be able to park his little wagon and sell sunglasses or sell hot dogs.
Well, the question I always ask myself is, you know, what's the reason for the rule? Who are we trying to protect? You know, what are we trying to accomplish? And if it's a feather sign, and if it's not having a negative impact, who really cares?
Well, that all came about.
I understand the sign rules.
It all came about from complaints. That's what started that with the vendors. They were starting to pop up everywhere, and nobody had authorized it, and they were questioning it. We had the French fry lady down on the Long Neck. That was a biggie. She was not there for that season, never came back. The only place you ever see that vending trailer now is at a show somewhere or Harrington Fair or somewhere else.
Then there was the one in front of the liquor store. They did application for a
hot dog. Oh, basically.
They wanted a hot dog stand so that
the little refrigerated cart.
Yeah.
I'm sure I could think of some more. That's the stuff I just noted down real quick to make sure that we. I just wanted to tell you about the vendor issue. The feather flags and the signs and it covered everything else.
Right.
And a cross section of the street on 99.
Yeah.
All right. One of the notes I made, are we running consistent with county council when, say, a conditional use, Mr. Ross's district fellow wants to operate a wrecker, and Marty says in the commission, you know, hours of operation, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Saturdays, this, that, and the other. Is county council with us on that? Because if you're saying certain hours and we don't have inspectors working that hour a day.
Sometimes we do. Sometimes
or the number
we don't.
Of employees, is that something, what's our guidance on that?
A couple of the council over the last year or so questioned why the commission is putting time limits on, and I tell them that the time limits are recommended by the commission based on what the applicant told them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They stated that for the commission. Now, the last couple of meetings when the time limits came up, I keep waiting for that question, and now they seem to be going along with it. Yesterday.
Tuesday, yeah, they just let it go.
They didn't seem to have a problem. Now, the one that they had the one issue on yesterday was the fact that the applicant was a dentist over near Route 13.
Yeah.
We had put in his time that he stated and added that emergency hours were permitted, if necessary. So that might have, they did question that. It's, they had a question the last two or three meetings.
I mean, to me, the thought process on that is, you know, does the county have the ability to enforce it, and B, does it set the county up for somebody claiming that the county is not enforcing its ordinances?
I agree with that. Oh.
Yeah.
Great.
That's
we don't have the manpower of people out there on weekends or after hours to check and see if they're. And it's all, again, it's based on complaint. And a lot of the council instruction to us is that most of the violations are based on complaint for business activities, that type of thing.
Well, it has to do what we say anyway.
So the instruction to us at the commission level would be to keep doing what we're doing, making our decisions.
I wouldn't change it.
Based on what's
and
we're,
I'll keep,
ahead
I'll
of
keep
us.
Telling them that it's based on the record of the applicant. And we didn't make them up.
Well, yeah.
The question was asked, or it was made part of his presentation, that this was his hours intended.
And I feel like sometimes we're helping to placate perhaps a neighbor that's voiced something where it's like,
we want to agree and let this fellow have the wrecking business, but we think, you know, yeah, maybe they don't want to hear that beep beep backup noise. Right. That such and such.
Most of the applicants,
as you say, split the baby.
Comply. Oh, we have a few that kind of want to do what they were doing all along.
I think to say because enforcement is a problem that we shouldn't have the regulations not right. And I don't even think that we can. I think it would be a stretch for someone to make an issue out of that. And you know, our whole tax code is voluntary. I mean, you have to do it. If they catch you violating, you know, but it's not like they come around to make sure you're paid.
I just know the kind of complaints we get.
Yeah. and that's how you have to do it. It's not. That's what I've said to folks when they said, "Who polices this?" I've said, "You do."
Right.
You know. And if you see an infraction, call.
But I mean, the staff still violate
people. Yeah, I know.
Violation.
Sure.
We have to do it all the time because people are complaining. Sometimes I'll see something and just question it. Next thing I know, they've been violated.
Right, because there's no unfairness in that, because every violation that's brought to our attention is addressed.
Right.
So they're all treated the same, but you can't treat what you don't know about, and you can't be held responsible
for
that.
The difficulty is that we go in and post violation on one property based on a complaint, and then that person that gets violated complains about another one. Next thing you know, we had four public hearings one night within a mile of each other because they were pointing fingers.
Everybody got to go.
Good for business.
That's right. Anything else, Mr. Lank? Are we good?
I think that's all.
What I'll do then is kind of put this together and maybe get on council's agenda and say this is sort of what we're thinking about. And
what we came up with.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll the board, it would probably wait and see what the board does and get together with Rick. And maybe you and Rick and I can go into the council and just give them a short 15 minutes of
here's what we're doing,
what we've looked at, and they may have some other issues or stuff that they would like to address.
Anyone else have anything for good of the order?
Thank you.